final investigator I met with was Dr. Gerald Radich to discuss new developments in management of chronic myelogenous leukemia, and to begin, he commented on perhaps the most discussed recent development in the field, the use of second-generation TKIs.
Imatinib is really remarkably successful in putting people into cytogenetic remission, where when you do a bone marrow, you don't find any evidence of disease. At a year, nearly 70% of patients will be in cytogenetic remission. And for those people who can tolerate the drug, that's maintained for a long time. The problem is that if you look at patients with imatinib, even though it's a beautiful drug, there are still people who really don't respond initially, sort of our primary resistance, that's probably 10 to 15%. And for patients who do get a response, you'll lose some patients because of intolerance to the drug, or some people will actually relapse later on the line. So if you look at follow-up of the imatinib trials now, only about 50% of patients are still on the drug. They've had to get off for those various three reasons. So even though imatinib is great, there's been room to improve. And that's where the second generation drugs have really come in. And those would be nilotinib and dasatinib. These drugs have been now approved by the FDA for primary use in upfront newly diagnosed CML chronic phase. And they look like they're even more effective than imatinib.
Can you talk about the biology of this disease and how TKIs work?
Yeah, so how all of these agents work is by the Philadelphia chromosome puts the upstream BCR gene domains and hooks them onto the tyrosine kinase domains of chromosome 9. The usual tyrosine kinase ABL is, in its normal form in you and me, is a nuclear protein. When you create this new union, the BCR and ABL, that actually goes out to the cytoplasm and there causes increased proliferation, block of apoptosis, and that's where you basically the effects of getting the cancer goes. So imatinib basically is directed at the binding domain, the ATP binding domain of the ABL. And what that does is it blocks that enzyme's ability to cause signal transduction by passing on phosphates. And imatinib, though, you know, there's also always a little bit of historical revisionism. Imatinib was a drug that was on the shelf already as a tyrosine kinase when Brian Druker began to do his experiments. It wasn't designed to specifically hit ABL, and it's a fairly dirty molecule, so it affects many other tyrosine kinases. The two other drugs, nilotinib and dasatinib, well, dasatinib is sort of in the same boat as imatinib is. It was designed actually as an immunomodulator drug, a SRC inhibitor. It just happens that it also blocks tyrosine kinases in ABL, about 30 to 100 times more tight binding to ABL than imatinib does. Nilotinib is a so-called rationally designed, quote-unquote, drug. So where they took the backbone of imatinib and designed it based on the X-ray crystallography structure of ABL to actually bind stronger. Nilotinib has the advantage that it's a relatively clean drug. It binds ABL and very little activity outside of that domain. So with dasatinib, that option, that blocks ABL spectacularly well, but also a whole host of other enzymes. And where nilotinib basically blocks ABL, and that's about it.
So maybe you can continue on in terms of what we know about these agents clinically.
Right. So the main thing has been throughout our series of phase 2 and 3 trials is that these drugs have shown to be remarkably consistent from study to study in their efficacy advantage compared to imatinib. So where if we say that with imatinib, about 70% of patients will go into complete cytogenetic remission at 12 months data, for both nilotinib and dasatinib, that figure is over 80%. And if you look at deeper responses, the so-called major molecular response, which is a 1,000-fold reduction in the BCR-ABL mRNA level, roughly about 30%, 40%, may get there with imatinib at 12 months. That value is almost doubled with nilotinib and dasatinib. So from those early surrogates, there's clearly an advantage. And then probably the most important surrogate for long-term response is progression to accelerated vasoblast crisis, which is really in this modern day the worst thing that can happen to patients because these drugs don't work very well in accelerated vasoblast crisis. In virtually all the trials so far, dasatinib and nilotinib have been very effective and have allowed for far less progressions than imatinib. Usually in those trials at a year to 2 years, that's less than 1% to 1% for these second generation drugs as compared to maybe 3 to 6% for imatinib. Now, the follow-up on dasatinib and nilotinib obviously isn't as long as imatinib, And so far, even though you can see the difference in these surrogates, there's been no difference in overall survival so far. But the FDA was willing to approve both of these drugs on those 12-month data and the progression-free survival data. So both of these drugs are almost equally superior in short-term efficacy. Long-term problems, we don't know. So for imatinib, we have plenty of long-term data about toxicity. Really, for dasatinib and nilotinib, we don't have that type of long-term data in regards to toxicity, although there's no signal yet that there'll be any difference.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about the comparative toxicology of the three drugs and maybe how you put it to patients.
Right. So as far as toxicity goes, imatinib has a lot of GI problems where people will get nausea, diarrhea, and a lot of peripheral edema problems. Those are the main problems that imatinib has. Both dasatinib and nilotinib actually don't have those issues. And these drugs are remarkable because they both display what we call cross intolerance. So if someone has a specific toxicity with imatinib, for instance, peripheral edema, they likely aren't going to get that with nilotinib or dasatinib. When you compare those toxicities to both nilotinib and dasatinib, nilotinib and dasatinib seem to have far less gut toxicity issues. Dasatinib, the main thing that people worry about are pleural effusions. With nilotinib, people worry about pancreatitis issues. And also with nilotinib, there's a black box warning for cardiac events, although it's not clear that those cardiac events really were associated with the nilotinib use.
Anything else you want to say about the issue of choice of initial treatment?
Many times, you know, you're faced with the conversation about what drug do you start with. So what you're up against is basically imatinib, which is a great drug, and we have lots of long-term follow-up data, versus dasatinib and nilotinib, which was a more effective drug, short-term, don't have a lot of long-term data. And patients really kind of fall into two groups. There are some that basically say, well, as long as you can monitor me carefully, I'm comfortable with the long-term complications of imatinib, let's go around and we'll switch if we have to. And then there's another camp that basically comes and says, well, if this is really more effective up front, I want to hit this thing as hard as I can. And I think physicians also fall into those two camps. And when you think about nilotinib and dasatinib versus imatinib, physicians fall into sort of what I call the infectious disease-like model and more of the transplant-heavy chemotherapy model. That is, some physicians will say, well, let's take this like an infectious disease doc, where we start with our cheaper, most benign, most well-known drug, and we keep our ace drug in the hole, and we only use that if we have to, versus the oncology approach, which is basically, let's just blast this thing as hard as we can and, you know, deal with anything that's left over later.
I'm trying to think of if I've encountered an investigator who kind of falls into the imatinib camp. Have you?
There are some investigators who are fine with imatinib, but it's generally now, I would say, I did a kind of informal poll where I'm on the NCNN guideline committee. I'm also on the ELN guideline committee, so I'm a honorary European. And so I talked to a bunch of docs around the country who treat a lot of CML. And I basically asked them, you know, what drug they would usually go on in what situations. And many of them are still comfortable with using imatinib, but usually those are in cases with what we call, there's a so-called score, which is basically a clinical score based on spleen size, white count, age, and the like. So people who have really low-risk disease, lowish white counts, no big spleen and the like, they're comfortable with starting them on that. But I think everyone now, sort of in the academic community, if someone shows up, you know, south of that with higher white counts, intermediate high risk, so-called, I think most of us are going to start them on a second generation drug.
And actually, the NCCN paper that came out about a year ago looking at that, that kind of is what I got out of that paper, that they were sort of okay with the low, but not okay.
That's exactly what our consensus came with, right?
What do we know about the pathophysiology of the edema with imatinib and the pleural effusions with dasatinib?
Oh, it's probably an effect on a different tyrosine kinase, probably platelet-derived growth factor. This is probably where that's happening. But the effusions that happen in dasatinib are probably a different animal. So there's been a number of studies now that show that when you give dasatinib, you get a very quick elevation of your NK lymphocytes. And if you look at effusions and tap those, you'll find that they have predominantly NK cells. So it's probably almost a more of an immunological-based effusion. Now, there's been a few studies that have suggested that those patients who get those effusions actually have better efficacy, which is really interesting because we've known for a long time that CML is a disease that really is sensitive to immune therapies of various kinds. And that's actually gotten people thinking that dasatinib might be used in transplant settings and chemotherapy settings outside of CML, if it really is an augment to NK cells.
How do you manage the pleural effusion with dasatinib, and would you restart it?
If it's mild, usually, you know, if you dose interrupt and see if that gets any better, diuretics, some people use steroids. I think realistically now, what most people would do is, unless there's some really, really compelling reason to keep them on dasatinib, is just to switch them.
Anything else you want to say about the decision in terms of initial therapy? Any questions you get about it?
No, I think that's the main one. The main one is, you know, the issue of what you would do. And I think that for most of us, intermediate, high grade, certainly a secondary tyrosine kinase, would feel fairly comfortable with imatinib in a low grade CML. But again, this is all predicated on monitoring people pretty carefully.
And that kind of leads to the question of monitoring. Maybe you can comment on that.
Right. So we have various ways to monitor people with CML. I mean, the classic way is to look at bone marrow cytogenetics. And that's been sort of the gold standard for years and years. That's most important in the diagnostic setting because if someone has additional cytogenetic abnormalities besides the Philadelphia chromosome, that usually gets in the diagnosis of advanced phase disease, and that gives you on a different clinical pathway. So getting a bone marrow for cytogenetics is really clearly important just before diagnosis. Along the way, there are guidelines that the NCNN and the ELN have put together, and they're virtually the same. And that is by the 3 months period, you want a complete hematologic remission, which that means just normalization of the peripheral blood counts. And by 6 months, you need to have some change in your cytogenetic status. Any improvement is okay. So if you start at 20 out of 20 metaphases being positive for the Philadelphia chromosome, even if you're at 17 out of 20, that's still considered on the right direction. By 12 months, we want you in at least a major cytogenetic remission, if not better. So that's basically eliminating 2/3 of your chromosomes or better. And by 18 months, we need you in a complete cytogenetic remission. Now, PCR, polymerase chain reaction of the peripheral blood, has really revolutionized monitoring because we typically do that every 3 months, starting at time of diagnosis, at best, at least starting at the point where you become cytogenetically negative. And PCR can really kind of help you monitor which way the disease is going in a very non-invasive way, basically doing it in peripheral blood. So if patients get into a major molecular remission, that's a 1,000-fold reduction in their PCR level, those patients are really what we call a safe haven. The rate of resistance or progression in that group is spectacularly low, less than 5%. On the other hand, if you're in complete cytogenetic remission, your PCR goes down and then starts to increase. There could be two reasons for that. One is the patient could be not taking their drug. The other is the disease is recurring. And this allows you to basically get a heads up, go back and do cytogenetic testing and see where their disease is.
So I received this email from an oncologist, Dr. Elizabeth Simmons. She said she listened to a program we did about CML and wanted to give some information about pleural effusion in a patient of hers on dasatinib. This is a patient with CML. Because the patient also had a history of breast cancer and a complex ovarian cyst and a rising CA125, she not only had two thoracentesis, both of which showed exudative lymphocytic effusion, she had a pleural biopsy, which shows lymphocytic pleuritis. The dasatinib was stopped, nilotinib started, effusion rapidly resolved, and CA125 fell to normal. Any comments?
I have not seen the association with the CA125 before. That's a very interesting one. But the response of switching over to nilotinib is classic. Generally, patients who have the lymphocytic response to dasatinib, that's specific to dasatinib, and so you would not expect that with nilotinib at all. So that was the right thing to do.
So what are some of the other questions you receive from oncologists about management of CML?
Many of them are, if someone is becoming resistant or they worry about resistance, when do you get mutation testing? And when you get mutation testing, what do you make of it? Right. And so the first issue is when to do mutation testing. So there's a bunch of stuff out there in the literature about how much of an increase in your PCR means anything. And some labs will say, well, you know, threefold, others will say fivefold, others will say tenfold. There's no really good data on when to go. But I think that people have to realize that like any test, the PCR test, it's basically done over a 6 log rhythmic range, right? I mean, it's exquisitely sensitive. And like any test, it's best in the middle, and both the high end and the low end, there's a fair amount of wobble in the assay. So when people say, oh, should I do point mutation testing if the PCR goes up fivefold? Well, if someone's at negative and they become 0.0001%, well, that's an infinite increase, right? You're not going to test someone who's like that. And if someone has very vanishingly small PCRs, even if there's a wobble, that's very hard to detect a point mutation in. So effectively, you need for the PCR to be rising and, you know, really at that MMR level or higher to really grab that sample and look for mutations. Now, typically what happens is the lab will report out, you know, if there's a mutation, what specific mutation it is. And then the issue is, what do I do with that data? Well, there's a number of tables throughout the literature where they look at drug sensitivity based on what point mutations. And people have to realize this is a very artificial system. What they do is you take a cell that doesn't have BCR-ABL and you introduce into it wild type. And then in other cells, you introduce in various, each of these point mutations. And then you grow them and you put on drug. And what you get is something called an IC50, inhibitory concentration of 50% of the cells. And so you're basically scaling up drug and saying, at what level of drug do I start actually killing these cells, right? And so it'll give you a color code in these things for every mutation. It'll show all the different tyrosine kinases and show you some that are mutations that are very sensitive and some that are very resistant. So if you have a patient who has a point mutation, all things being equal, if there's not any other reason to drive you towards one drug or the other, you can look at that point mutation, compare the IC50s for all the different drugs, and pick the one that makes the most sense, where the mutation will be the most sensitive to. Now, that being said, that always doesn't work. And there are cases where you say, boy, this clone should be exquisitely sensitive to this drug, I'm going to use that one, and it doesn't. And then vice versa, there are some where you haven't bothered to look and just put them on a drug and it goes away and it shouldn't, right? So that just tells us there's a lot more to this than we understand. The most important one to figure out, though, is one mutation called the T315I mutation. And that's important because none of the commercially available drugs right now, imatinib, dasatinib, or nilotinib, are effective in that. And so those patients, to get that mutation, you have to really be thinking about a drug trial with an agent that might be effective in that or going to transplant.
And what agents do we know right now affect that specific mutation?
There is a drug called ponatinib that is in trial. It will soon be going in phase 3 trials. And that in the resistance in the early trials have been remarkably effective. So I think if you have a patient with a 315i, go to the ARIAD website, find out where they're going to be doing their trials, and get your patient on one.
I know another common question that oncologists have is about the possibility of discontinuing therapy and the issue of cure.
Ah, yes.
One comment?
Yeah, this is fascinating. You know, surprisingly enough, if you grab a cell in a CML sample that you putatively think is a quote-unquote CML stem cell and grow those in culture and put any of these agents on it, grow them in tyrosine kinase inhibitor, whether they're imatinib, dasatinib, or nilotinib, these cells don't die. So for another reason, the CML stem cell, which is fairly quiescent and divides slowly, isn't killed by these agents. And so when we knew that, we figured, well, people are going to have to stay on drug forever because, you know, there's always going to be a reservoir of stem cells and you're never going to get rid of it. So, well, that doesn't seem to be the case. There's been now 3 trials that have been out there. The longest one is the so-called STIM trial, STIM, out of France. And what those trials have done is looked at patients who have been in continuous complete molecular remission, which means undetectable PCR for BCR-ABL, for at least 2 years. So they've been negative for 2 years. And you take them off the imatinib, and you say, what happens? Well, in 60% of those patients, the disease comes back. And that's usually within 3 months. You give them back, reintroduce them back to imatinib, challenge them again, and they all respond. So that's good. But in 40%, patients have stayed completely PCR negative for now over 2 years, which I think is absolutely shocking to most of us who do CML biology. Now, when you think about it, maybe it's not surprisingly, but the people who have been able to get off the drug are those that present with low SOCOL risk. So where they present with relatively small white counts, relatively small spleens. I think why that biologically makes sense is that we know that BCR-ABL, among the other things it does, is it causes genetic instability. So some of the additional genetic abnormalities, chromosomal breaks that occur, point mutations, gene expression, etc., are driven by unopposed BSC-ABL activity. You really never know when someone comes in the door at CML how long they've had the disease. But the only thing that correlates with it is their white count and their spleen size, because those at one time were normal. And they may increase at different times in different patients, but in general, that's the best thing you have to track with the actual time they've had from the beginning of the Philadelphia chromosome to actually showing up in clinic. So if you think that BCR-ABL causes genetic instability and that the SoCal score is sort of your only surrogate of how long you've had the disease, it makes some sense that the patients with the lowest SoCal score who haven't had the disease very long, they probably haven't gotten additional genetic abnormalities and the like, right? So they actually may be able to stop their drug. Now, it's very important that people, when they hear this data, it's very encouraging, but you have to realize that this is something you have to do on a clinical trial. Because even though all the people that so far have been discontinued and relapse, on rechallenge, they've responded again, they all haven't gone back to negative again. And if you believe that unopposed BCR-ABL is what drives progression, you've given a person 3 months, 6 months of unopposed BCR-ABL, they may respond, but they may have developed clones in there that are going to now go on the road to progression. And so I don't think we'll really know the fate of those patients until 3-5 years from now. When patients' peripheral blood BCR-ABL rises, there's two reasons that can happen. You know, one is the patient isn't taking their drug. The other is the disease is coming back. Now, people who get a major molecular response, I talked a little earlier that that's a pretty safe haven. So it's really unusual for people who have had a major molecular response who are still taking their drug for their disease to come back. So if you have a patient whose PCR goes up tenfold and they were in that situation, the first thing you have to ask them is, are you taking your drug? Because many people, well, not many people, but one of the common scenarios you hear about is people have gotten a great response and they say, okay, fine, this is a good time to take a holiday. I've got a great response, the disease isn't there, it's going away, let's, you know, save some money, save some GI distress, you know, whatever. So that's actually the earliest, best indication. For imatinib, you can also find labs that will do imatinib drug levels, which might help, although typically those have been tough because you have to make sure people take the drug at the right time. Many patients, if they know they're being tested, you know, there's a worry that they will in fact get the fear of God and take their drug just before the test, and that makes it look better than it is. I think the main thing you have to do is, if you're worried about compliance, you have to develop a conversation where people will really be frank, because they have to realize that if you really think that things are going in the wrong direction, it's going to set off a series of responses that, you know, another bone marrow, maybe changing their drug with different toxicities, you know, it's going to set off a series of events. So it's a time to basically really have a frank conversation about that.
Any other sort of practical issues before we kind of get into new research directions?
I guess a practical issue would be for physicians who are forced to change drugs because of resistance. And then the question becomes, well, how long do I try these drugs, the second generation drugs, before I give up and go to third line, including like transplantation? And there's been a couple of studies that have looked at that. And the studies from the MD Anderson, the long and short of it is, they usually give people 12 months of second generation drug. And if the patient has had at least a major cytogenetic response, they say, fine. Hammersmith in London, which does a lot of work, they basically pick the 3 month mark. So they say you have to have had at least a hematological response and a minor cytogenetic response by 3 months. If not, we're going to change and go to transplant. Now, the practical situation, that's what we do around in Seattle because of the issue of transplantation. If a patient becomes resistant and you decide to look for a donor, it typically takes, you know, in the United States, most people don't have family member donors, and you have to go to an unrelated donor search. That search usually takes around 4 months. So from a practical standpoint, when I talk to people about this, if a patient has become resistant, I start the second generation drug or switch drugs. You know, if you were on a second generation, if you have to go to a different second generation drug, start the search at the same time. And when a donor is ready in 3 to 4 months, reassess. If they've had a great response, keep going. If they haven't had a great response, then you move to transplant. Because the thing you don't want to do in patients where a transplant's an option is wait too late. You know, for the last, you know, since the mid-70s, 80s to now, transplant results in chronic phase have gotten better. So you usually expect that we would cure 85% of patients in chronic phase. Results in accelerated phase and blast crisis haven't improved since the 80s. So if you wait too long and you have to transplant in accelerated phase instead of chronic phase, you're talking about a 40% survival.
What about the issue of quality control in labs in terms of monitoring?
When you look at monitoring, the standard way that things are going is by PCR. And one of the things that is very difficult is that these PCR assays have been typically what we call homebrews. And that is, a lab has a particular interest in the disease, they develop an assay. So when the first CML trials started, the big international trials, there were three labs doing PCR-able assays. Our lab did all of US and Canada, Hammersmith did all of Europe, and Adelaide did all of the Asian and Australia samples. These are obviously proliferated, so that these assays now are throughout the world. Hundreds of labs do them. But the problem is that how I do the assay is a little bit different than how you do the assay. And therefore, it's very hard to compare your values exactly with my values. And so there's been an effort to try to get an international standardization, but that's been very difficult to actually pull off for a variety of reasons. But it's on the horizon now. There's actually a company that is finally now going to market standardized reagents that we can all use as comparators, so that with my assay, I can put it in a, take my assay, multiply it by a certain factor, you have your assay multiplied by a different factor, and we'll be able to talk the same language.
For the time being, what can an oncologist do in terms of trying to figure out whether the lab they're using, they can essentially trust the results?
Yeah, that's a big issue.
Do they look down to the bottom and see whether this has been calibrated with the international scale? That's about as far as I can get it.
That's about as far as you can get. There's, I think right now, about 5 labs in the U.S. that do international scale. You can have a reliable lab that doesn't have the international scale, and they'll still be useful, right, if you basically keep using that lab. One of the problems is that many docs belong to a practice where they, outsource the assay, and these are under contracts. So the contracts might change year to year. And so you're doing lab A for a couple of years, and now your facility's negotiated a contract with lab B, and that makes it very difficult because you really then can get the apples and orange situation. The other major thing in headway, I think, as we were talking about the assays, is that building a more sensitive assay. So the usual PCR assays can get down to, roughly 1 leukemic cell and 10 to the 5th normal cells and the like. And if we think that complete molecular remission is an important thing, we have to have as much sensitivity as we can to really pick out those people who we cannot find disease with. And so there's a number of efforts now to really sort of jazz up the normal PCR assays to get sensitivities down to 1 in a million, 1 in 10 to the 7th. And hopefully that will help us define which of those patients who are in complete MR by our sort of routine test really have even lower levels of non-detectable disease versus those that are just under that threshold, and those might be the ones that you expect will relapse. The main thing I try to emphasize is that there's many ways now to skin the cat, let's say. And none of them are perfect and none of them are etched in stone. But I think that the thing we can do is we can be diligent about monitoring, and we can be diligent about talking about compliance. And with that, you can really tailor therapy, I think, to 99% of your patients. If you have the talk about, what's your lifestyle? How can you take twice-a-day drugs, once-a-day drugs? How is that going to affect you? Here's our monitoring plan. Here's when we're going to make a move. And don't forget that even in the days of these remarkable drugs, transplantation still has a role. In the old days, 12 years ago, in fact, the transplanters got the call as soon as the diagnosis was made. Now things have swayed the other way. Since people have gotten used to tyrosine kinases, they often now wait way too long to give the transplant call because they will keep trying one drug, then the other drug, and the other drug. And the thing we worry about, I think there's a sense in the community that resistance to these drugs may be forever, in the sense that if you have a situation where someone has become resistant, one way to think of resistance is it's a Darwinian experiment. You have multiple clones, you give a drug, you select out resistant clones, you give another drug, you eventually select out totally resistant cells.
Any other, I don't know if I'd use the word myths, but maybe misperceptions that you think might be out there in the community?
Yeah, one thing that's out there is that, and this again gets to the old infectious disease model we talked about, a lot of docs will say, I kind of like the concept of trying on imatinib because then I've got a stronger drug, right? And some docs won't go to the stronger drug because they say, if I give the stronger drug and they fail, then what am I going to do, right? And I sort of understand that, but it's sort of the logic sort of reversed, because if you get the stronger drug, your chance of ever getting to resistance is a lot less, right? And so if you really think along the lines that you really don't want resistance, then starting with a stronger drug makes a lot more sense than holding it back.